United Nations in New York, on the eve of the opening of its 16th Assembly session, is plunged into mourning upon the passing of Dag Hammarskjöld. More than 8 years ago, on April 14, 1953, he had assumed his difficult post as the successor to Trygve Lie. The serious, quietly courageous Swedish diplomat was to bring new stature to the job of Chief Administrative Officer of the UN. And in his quest for peace, he met death. In mournful tribute, the flags of the member nations are removed from their poles in front of the world headquarters, even while the first impacts are felt in far-flung capitals of the globe. Hammarskjöld's death in the line of duty could rock the very foundations of the UN. A lone UN banner flies at half-staff as saddened colleagues gather at a news conference to make the official announcement of the Secretary General's death in the wilds of Central Africa. He was en route to peace talks with Katanga President Moise Tshombe when he perished in the crash of the plane flying him from Leopoldville, the Congo, to Ndola, northern Rhodesia. The Brazilian Undersecretary for Public Information, H. Tavares de Sá, speaks.
In keeping with the spirit which typified the dedicated efforts of Mr. Hammarskjöld, the Secretariat is carrying on with a full sense of its duty. May I add that I'm sure I interpret the feeling of all my colleagues and all our fellow workers in this house and wherever the United Nations is at work in the cause of peace, to say that this is a tragic loss for the United Nations, for the cause of peace everywhere, and for humanity.
During his 8 years as Secretary General, leaders throughout the world...
Rhodesian Federation, 1961.
Here, President Eisenhower.
Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has just been killed in a horrific plane crash just outside the airport of the city of Ndola. Hammarskjöld was en route to negotiate a ceasefire agreement with Moise Tshombe, the president of the secessionist government of Katanga. During the conflict known as the Congo Crisis, the state of Katanga seceded from Congo. Although Katanga presented itself as a homegrown independence movement, it was financed and directed largely by European-owned mining companies, and its military officer corps was made up of ruthless, battle-hardened white mercenaries. Dag Hammarskjöld was an advocate of black majority rule in Africa, and the presence of these white mercenaries in the Congo was a violation of the UN mandate. UN forces began to clash with the Katangese in a swiftly escalating conflict. Seeing an opportunity to negotiate a favorable peace, Hammarskjöld arranged to meet Tshombe in the white-ruled Rhodesian Federation. But the Secretary General's plane would never arrive. Just 15 minutes after midnight, on September 18, 1961, the DC-6 aircraft carrying Dag Hammarskjöld and his staff burst into flames and crashed in the bush near Ndola Airport. The official investigation from the Rhodesians settled on pilot error as the cause of the unfortunate accident. Of course, many of Hammarskjöld's supporters suspected foul play. After 60 years, there's still no smoking gun to prove the plane was sabotaged or shot down, or who did it. But there is still a substantial amount of evidence that suggests the midnight plane crash in Central Africa that killed Dag Hammarskjöld was anything but an accident. This is a conspiracy you can believe in. Welcome back to Conspiracy You Can Believe In, a show about plots and conspiracies throughout history that might actually be true. And if you're a regular listener, you might notice that this is my first show in about 2 months. I apologize, but I got a little busy at my day job this spring, and unfortunately I didn't have time to complete an episode in my off hours. I'm also a parent of a 2-year-old. Thanks for bearing with me, and I think you're going to like this one. Because if you're the type of person who likes to go down rabbit holes about unsolved crimes and Cold War espionage, the death of Dag Hammarskjöld is a fertile field for that kind of thing. Now, although it seems straightforward, there was a plane crash that killed the head of the UN. Was it sabotage, or was it an accident? It's not that simple. This is a complicated and meandering story that can bring you to a few different conclusions. And unless you're an expert on 20th century African history, you probably need some background information to put it all into context. I will do my best to summarize, to explain the sequence of events, and to get things as right as best I can. But like I always say, I'm not an expert, this is a hobby, so take my opinions with a grain of salt. If you want an account of the Hammarskjöld plane crash from a professional historian, I recommend the source that I use for this episode, a book called Who Killed Hammarskjöld by Susan Williams. It's a gripping, well-written account of the crash itself and the author's own investigation into what happened. Williams traveled the world talking to witnesses who saw the crash, uncovering previously unknown first-hand accounts of the original investigation. It's a legit scholarly work. And it helped spark the UN to reopen their investigation to Hammarskjöld's crash, which is still ongoing. I also referenced some information from the 2019 documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld by the Danish filmmaker Mads Brügger and the Swedish Foreign Service worker Göran Björkdahl. It's an entertaining movie, and Brügger teased out some interesting new information from some of his interview subjects that I'll discuss later in the episode. Also, in the very small chance that the name Göran Björkdahl rings any bells, he was the investigator that I mentioned in the Olof Palme episode who extracted an admission of guilt for that assassination from a South African general. So let's get into the episode. For starters, if you want to know what happened to Dag Hammarskjöld, you need to know about the Congo crisis. If you listen to my episode on the killing of Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba, you have most of the context you need, but I'll try to give a condensed version here. In 1960, what we today call the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which I'll call Congo throughout this episode, gained its independence from Belgium. European colonial rule over Africa was oppressive and harsh, but the Belgian Congo is considered a particularly brutal example of colonialism, even by those standards. It began in the 1880s, when King Leopold II of Belgium established direct personal rule over the Congo River Basin. Although Leopold never visited the Congo himself, the social order he established in his African fiefdom was one built on forced labor and bloodshed on a massive scale. The Congolese were required to harvest and deliver impossible quotas of natural rubber to the colonial authorities, on pain of dismemberment or death, and often entire villages would be burned, or civilians would have hands chopped off if they refused to comply. Natives were forced to take part in dangerous construction and railroad projects, and the violent social upheaval caused by the arrival of the Belgians also spread deadly pandemics. It's hard to say how many Congolese were killed in this period, but estimates run as high as up to 10 million human beings. The situation got so bad that the Belgian government took control of the colony from Leopold in the early 20th century, although things didn't improve that much. There was still a rigid system of segregation imposed on the native Africans by their European overlords. And although the Congo Basin is rich in agricultural and especially mineral resources, all the wealth from the plantations and mines ended up back in Brussels. By 1960, the Africans of the Congo had had enough. Through a fierce campaign of protest and civil disobedience, they won independence in 1960, electing the staunch anti-colonial nationalist Patrice Lumumba in May of that year as the prime minister of a coalition government. But thanks to a combination of internal factors and external pressures from Europe and the United States, Lumumba's coalition began to fall apart almost immediately. an independence movement in Katanga, a mineral-rich region covering the southern quarter of the country, seceded from the Congo just 3 months after the prime minister was elected. On paper, this government was led by a wealthy black African businessman named Moise Tshombe. In reality, Katanga was a puppet government of the Union Minière Mining Company, a Belgian and British-owned firm that extracted the vast resources of copper, gold, tin, and uranium found in Katanga. The tax revenue from Union Minière alone was historically a significant percentage of the old Belgian colony's revenue. If Katanga broke off and took the mines with them, it was bad news for the newly independent Congo. And this is how the Congo crisis began. Patrice Lumumba fought hard to keep his young country together. He felt that if he could maintain the Congo as one large, centrally run republic, it would have a better chance at fighting off this new form of colonialism being practiced by companies like Union Minière. So, Lumumba marshaled the Congolese forces to fight the secessionist enemy within, and was immediately beset by an enemy from without. Belgian forces returned to the Congo, ostensibly to protect Belgian citizens who remained in the country, but really to win back some kind of control over their former colony. Lumumba's commitment to independence won him many powerful enemies. His president unconstitutionally dissolved his government, he was put under house arrest, and the CIA at one point even tried to kill him with poisoned toothpaste. If there was one thing resembling an ally of Lumumba's government outside of Africa, it would be Dag Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld was an unlikely defender of decolonization. A bookish European diplomat and government minister, Hammarskjöld came from a respected noble family in Sweden. His father, at one point, had even been prime minister. But Dag was studious, incorruptible, and raised with a patrician sense of social justice for the powerless. As the Secretary General of the UN, this translated into his reliable protection of smaller, independent nations from the great powers of the world. Hammarskjöld supported the concept of majority rule and self-government in the African continent. And as such, he was one of the few white world leaders to recognize Patrice Lumumba as the legitimate elected leader of the Congo. Unfortunately, I would argue that Hammarskjöld was also a little naive about the situation that Lumumba found himself in. Although Hammarskjöld recognized the prime minister as legitimate, he also believed that the UN's mission in the Congo was pacification, not maintaining the integrity of the country. Throughout the early stages of the Congo crisis in 1960, UN forces were dispatched to neutralize conflict. And while this meant they were there to maintain peace and order, it also meant they prevented Lumumba's armies from squashing the rebellion in Katanga as soon as possible. This allowed Moise Tshombe and his backers in Union Minière to gather their forces and shore up sources of income. By this point, it was Lumumba and his supporters against the world. The CIA and European powers established relationships with Patrice's rivals, like Colonel Joseph Désiré Mobutu, who took over the government in a coup and had Lumumba thrown into prison by the close of 1960. In January of 1961, under direction from the Belgian government, Patrice Lumumba was flown to Katanga, where he would be executed by a firing squad under orders from white Belgian mercenaries. Lumumba's death changed Hammarskjöld's approach to the Congo. He realized he could no longer treat Katanga with kid gloves. And in fact, many protesters blamed him and the UN for Lumumba's murder when the assassination became public. The Secretary General realized the biggest problem in Katanga was their force of highly trained white mercenaries, hired from the very deep pockets of Union Minière. These men came from Belgium, France, Rhodesia, Britain, and South Africa. Their motives range from adventure-seeking and wealth to pure ideological commitment to white supremacy, as well as various mixtures of these factors in between. Some officers in the Katangi's army had ties to the OAS, or Secret Army Organization. That was a French terrorist group dedicated to preserving white rule in Algeria. It should not surprise you that these mercenaries carried out a number of atrocities against the black African civilians in the Congo. By February of 1961, the UN passed a resolution demanding the expulsion of these mercenaries. The UN commander in charge of carrying out this mission was the Irish politician Conor Cruise O'Brien, who oversaw a force of UN soldiers from Ireland and India in the southern region of the Congo. The Katangan government and their Belgian allies were resistant for months, and by August, Hammarskjöld approved O'Brien to carry out Operation Rum Punch, the forcible arrest of dozens of leading Belgian military officials and white mercenaries. This operation was a success, with O'Brien's soldiers capturing Katangan aircraft and occupying key positions in the capital of Elizabethville. But what followed would be open conflict with the Katangi's army and their battle-hardened white officer corps. Operation Rum Punch was followed up with a surprise attack on remaining mercenary leaders a few weeks later. But this maneuver didn't go as planned. A group of mostly Irish UN soldiers, answering a distress call in the Katangan city of Jadotville, found themselves lured into a trap and surrounded by Katangi's troops and white mercenaries. They held out for 5 days under withering artillery fire and strafing attacks from a Fuga jet in the service of Katanga's small air force. The Irish soldiers signaled a message to UN command in the capital of Leopoldville. Quote, "We will hold out until last bullet is spent. Could do with some whiskey." But finally, on September 17th, the UN troops ran out of ammo and were forced to surrender. It was around this time that Hammarskjöld sought to broker a ceasefire with Katanga's president, Moise Tshombe, and for good reason. Just south of the Congo lay the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland, which comprises the present-day countries of Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Malawi. At that time, the Rhodesian Federation was a British protectorate ruled exclusively by a white minority. Their Prime Minister, Roy Walensky, was fending off a self-government movement from black Africans in his country, and maintained a close alliance with the breakaway government of Katanga. He saw offensives like Operation Rum Punch as a threat to white government, and potentially an invitation to communism in Central Africa. Walensky responded by amassing troops and aircraft on the border with the Congo. The Prime Minister's language was belligerent and dangerous, even threatening that further conflict in Katanga could spark a Third World War. Hammarskjöld summoned the British government to help him defuse the situation. After meeting with an official from the UK, the Secretary General decided to arrange a summit with British authorities and Moise Tshombe in Ndola, that's spelled N-D-O-L-A, a city in the Rhodesian Federation just across the border from Katanga. Conor Cruise O'Brien, the UN commander in Katanga, warned Hammarskjöld against this location. The Rhodesian Federation was not exactly friendly territory for the earnest liberal Swedish diplomat committed to black African self-rule. But Dog was insistent, and thanks to previously secret documents uncovered by Susan Williams in her book, we know that the British intelligence service MI6 was possibly instrumental in setting the location of the summit. One report from an MI6 agent named Neil Ritchie, dated September 25, 1961, details an attempt from the agent to broker a meeting between Tshombe and O'Brien. But Tshombe insisted to meet with Hammarskjöld himself. Hearing that Hammarskjöld agreed to arrive in Rhodesia himself after meeting with a British official, Ritchie brought Tshombe to the Ndola airport by the evening of September 17th. Meanwhile, in the Leopoldville airport, Hammarskjöld and his staff were all preparing to board the Albertina, a Swedish-owned and crewed DC-6 transport plane, to fly to Ndola and connect with Tshombe. Before the flight, the Albertina needed to be repaired, since it flew out of Katanga that morning and received a bullet hole in its exhaust pipe from separatists. For much of its time at the airport in Leopoldville, however, the plane was left unguarded. Although the ladder was up and the doors were sealed, it was possible for someone to access the plane through the undercarriage. With some unexpected delays, the Albertina left for Indola as planned on the evening of September the 17th, carrying Hammarskjöld, 10 of his staff and security guards, as well as the 5 Swedish crew members. The plane had to take a roundabout course to Rhodesia to avoid Katangan airspace, traveling east to Lake Tanganyika, then south, then west to Indola. At the airport at Indola, Moise Tshombe awaited the Secretary General along with Rhodesian officials, as well as a man named Lord Alport, the British High Commissioner to the Rhodesian Federation. This is like an ambassador from Britain to Commonwealth countries. Except for Tshombe, who the Rhodesians made an exception for, black Africans were not allowed within the perimeter of the airport. But just outside, dozens of native Africans were gathered to express their support for Hammarskjöld and his mission. Many people in the Rhodesian Federation were beginning to openly protest and agitate against white minority rule, cheering for the UN Secretary General that their own government nearly went to war against was one way they could show their discontent. In the control tower at Indola, the traffic controller had no equipment to record his conversation with the Albertina pilots, so anything we know of the last minutes of the flight comes from the notes that the controller wrote down the next day. After delivering weather information to the Albertina, the Indola control tower tried in vain to squeeze information about the Secretary General's next destination after landing at the airport. Next, the UN plane reported the beginning of its descent 10 minutes after midnight. And then, nothing. Contact with the Albertina had been lost. Lord Alport, the British High Commissioner, encouraged calm and said that Hammarskjöld probably decided to go elsewhere at the last minute, most likely to Katanga, to meet with the head of UN forces there. Finally, 2 hours after the loss of contact, the air traffic controller wired the Rhodesian capital about what happened before shutting down the airport for the night. It seemed to many officials that there was no cause for concern. But as we know, this was an emergency situation, and several witnesses saw it with their own eyes. A white police officer in Indola hurried to his police station to report a huge flash of light in the sky. Drillers, construction workers, and charcoal burners working at night throughout the region reported the same thing. Rhodesian authorities were initially slow to respond. By 7 in the morning on September 18th, a different UN plane arrived at Indola Airport, redirected from another mission to search for Hammarskjöld and the Albertina. A few planes from the Rhodesian Air Force began to fly overhead, searching for wreckage. It wasn't until a little after 3 p.m. on the 18th that they spotted the crash site, only 8 miles from the airport and almost 15 hours after the plane lost contact. Local police arrived at the still smoldering crash scene to cordon off the area and investigate. And then here's where things get really weird. For one, they found a survivor, an American named Harold Julian, who was Hammarskjöld's head of security. Julian had managed to pull the emergency tab and escape the plane just before it exploded, which meant that he was injured, badly burned, but alive and able to speak. This was not so for the other 15 passengers. All of the bodies were charred, except for Hammarskjöld's, whose corpse did not seem to have any evidence of burns at all. And something that was either overlooked at the crime scene or deliberately allowed to happen, there are no in situ photographs of Hammarskjöld's body. That is, there are no pictures of the corpse in the position and place where it was found at the crash site. The only pictures that exist of the Secretary General at the site of his death are his body on a stretcher as it was about to be taken into an ambulance. And remember when I said things got weird? Well, here's where it really starts to kick in. In the picture, there appears to be something resembling a bullet hole on Hammarskjöld's neck. Also visible in these pictures is what appears to be a playing card tucked into Hammarskjöld's collar. At least one photographer who was at the site told Susan Williams, the author of Who Killed Hammarskjöld, that this card was the Ace of Spades, a symbol that traditionally means death. Now, we do know that something resembling a playing card was in Hammarskjöld's collar, because it's clearly in the picture. We don't know for sure if it was the Ace of Spades, or if that was just a coincidence, but Susan Williams uncovered something else very suspicious in her research. After obtaining both the autopsy photographs and the photos of the Secretary General taken at the crash site, Williams took them to Dr. Ian Van Hagen, a pathologist at Oxford University who specializes in autopsies involving gunshot wounds. In two photographs, one from the crash site and one from the autopsy, Dr. Van Hagen found a whitish circle near the right eye, something that wouldn't have naturally appeared in Hammarskjöld's condition. He suspected that these could be attempts to doctor the image. This would line up with the account of Knut Hammarskjöld, who was Dag's nephew, who arrived in Indola immediately after the crash. According to Knut, the local police gave him a set of photographs showing his uncle's body with a smooth forehead. But right after leaving the mortuary, a police officer took him aside and told him, quote, "You may find these interesting," and gave him a different set of undoctored photos, ones that showed some sort of injury on Dag's head. All of this is very strange, but it doesn't prove anything on its own. There were three official investigations in the 20th century into the plane crash that killed Dag Hammarskjöld. The first one would happen immediately after the incident, and it would be directed by the authorities of the country in which the crash occurred, that is, the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. Now, as I said earlier, the Rhodesian Federation was a majority black African country, but explicitly governed by a white minority. The regime maintained a rigid system of segregation, denied basic civil rights to black residents, and it was adamantly opposed to Hammarskjöld. Remember, after the United Nations carried out Operation Rum Punch, the Rhodesian Federation moved troops to the border with Katanga, and they threatened to go to war with the UN. These would be the people deciding what witnesses would be heard, what evidence would be considered, and what story would be told to the world about Hammarskjöld's plane crash. And every step of the way, the first investigation was guided by the principles of white supremacy on which the Rhodesian Federation was built. It should be no surprise that within less than 2 months, the Rhodesians settled on pilot error as the cause of the crash. In a statement released on November the 2nd, 1961, Rhodesian officials claimed that while they could not completely rule out some outside force causing the plane to go down, it most likely crashed because of a careless misreading of the altimeters. One of the foreign observers of the investigation who found fault with the way the Rhodesians handled things was a man named Bo Wirfing, a Swedish aerospace engineer. He kept detailed records of witness statements and notes from the investigation immediately after the crash. Thanks to these records finally finding the light of day in the 21st century, we can today see the Rhodesian investigation for what it was: a cover-up. Most importantly, the racist society of the Rhodesian Federation intimidated several black witnesses who saw the crash with their own eyes from coming forward. The country was in the midst of a campaign of civil disobedience against white minority rule, a protest movement known as the Cha-Cha-Cha. Backlash from the white ruling class could be brutal. Coming forward to give testimony that contradicts the message that white Rhodesians wanted to send could land a black witness in contempt of court, or worse. But some witnesses did come forward, and their stories were consistent. They saw at least two planes the night Hammarskjöld's plane went down, not one. And one of them was shooting or dropping bombs at the other. Bo Wirfing noted in his records that the white court officials rushed black witnesses through their testimony, disrespected them, and then, in their final reports, dismissed them as drunk, childish, or imagining things. One of the black witnesses who had his testimony discounted during the Rhodesian investigation was a man named Timothy Kankasa. Like many others who saw the plane crash, he was a charcoal burner who was at work that night in the bush on the outskirts of Indola. He claimed that he saw one big airplane flying low and another smaller aircraft above it, followed by two flashes of light that seemed to follow from the smaller plane to the larger one. His wife, Chibesa Kankasa, also saw a flash in the sky that night, with two planes flying away. The court found Timothy Kankasa's account unreliable, and many of the charcoal burners who saw multiple planes in the sky at the moment Dag Hammarskjöld's plane went down were also dismissed as simple rural folk who could have no idea what they really saw. But the Kankasas were anything but simple people. Timothy was an official in the charcoal burners' union, as well as the local town clerk, and most importantly, he served in the Royal Air Force as a signalman during World War II. He knew planes. Chibesa Kankasa was also a respected community member, a social worker who would go on to be respected as one of the founders of modern Zambia, and who would serve as the country's Minister of Women's Affairs for 20 years. These are the people who the Rhodesian officials believed were not sophisticated enough to give their testimony. What's more, the charcoal burners, who looked up to the sky on midnight of September 18th and saw one aircraft cause another to burst into flames, all lived very close to the airport, and they had for some time. The white judges who dismissed their testimony expect us to believe that all of these people, who reported what they saw with their own eyes, somehow were confused and mystified about the concept of airplanes. Amazingly, another key witness that the Rhodesian inquiry discredited was Harold Julian, who was the only survivor of the crash. Julian was badly burned, but conscious and able to speak to the police when they found him on the afternoon of September 18th. As he was being driven to a hospital, Julian told a police inspector that the plane exploded in the sky before the crash, and that he only managed to get out by pulling the emergency tab before it went down. Nursing staff said that Julian spoke about sparks in the sky before the moment the plane crashed, and he said that Dag Hammarskjöld yelled, "Go back," or "Turn back," the moment before the plane crashed outside the airport. Harold Julian's doctor testified that his patient was, quote, "lucid and coherent" the entire time. The Rhodesian Commission dismissed the only survivor of the wreck of the Albertina as rambling, and his testimony was ignored. Harold Julian was severely injured, but his doctors expected him to survive with a few months of treatment in the hospital. Unfortunately, just 6 days after the crash, Harold Julian suddenly developed renal failure, and he died of uremia. In October of 1961, just before the Rhodesian investigation would announce the crash was the cause of pilot error, the UN opened their own investigation. Unlike the Rhodesians, the UN actively sought out the testimony of African laborers who saw the crash itself. Some new witnesses even came forward. Two charcoal burners who had been working at their kiln claimed that they saw two planes, one large and flying low, one much smaller and flying higher. A red flash appeared on the big plane, followed by an explosion and a crash. Terrified, the two men hid behind an anthill, believing that they were witnessing an invasion. Instead, they saw two Land Rovers, driven by white men, speed down the road next to them into the direction of the crash. 15 minutes after the vehicles disappeared, there was a new eruption of flames from the crash site, and the Land Rovers came zooming back. "I have no doubt," one of the men told the UN officials, "that they had something to do with increasing the flames." Now, many of these new witnesses openly said they were too frightened to come forward with their testimony during the Rhodesian investigation, for fear of reprisal. Although their testimony was taken more seriously by the UN, the commission still included some Rhodesian officials as counsel who did their best to discredit these witnesses. In the end, the UN investigation delivered an open verdict, meaning they could not conclusively state if the plane was shot down or if it was merely an accident. A further investigation by the Swedish government in 1993 backed up the conclusion of the Rhodesian investigators, claiming that there was no foul play. Since then, that has been the official position of the Swedish government, though it should be noted that 19 years later, the chief investigator of the Swedish Commission appeared to have changed his mind, and was at that point no longer sure that Hammarskjöld's death was an accident. Personally, I am convinced at this point that Dag Hammarskjöld's plane was almost certainly shot down. In fact, I'm a bit more convinced of this one than most of the conspiracy theories that have some shred of truth to them. And as more evidence from this case comes to light, I am not the only one. In 2014, the UN formed a new commission to reopen the investigation, which is still ongoing. And a lot of that is thanks to the hard work that people like Susan Williams and the investigator Göran Björkdahl did on this case. I'd like to take a minute to talk about one of the witnesses that Williams brought to the public eye in her book, a man named Charles Southall. Southall is a former National Security Agency officer who at the time of Hammarskjöld's plane crash was stationed at a joint CIA-NSA listening post in Cyprus. His job was to process intercepted transmissions picked up by the station, and although he typically worked during the day, a communications officer that he knew encouraged him to show up at midnight one September day in 1961. "Get yourself out here tonight," the officer said. "Something interesting is going to happen." When Southall arrived at the listening post, he and a few other officers gathered around a loudspeaker a bit after midnight to listen to a recording of a recent transmission. It was a one-sided communication from a pilot in the cockpit of a plane. Southall recalls that the voice of the pilot was calm and professional. The voice from the cockpit announced the appearance of a DC-6 transport plane beneath it, and that it was about to make a run on the aircraft. The sound of gunfire erupted, followed by, quote, "I've hit it. There are flames. It's going down. It's crashing." Southall does not completely remember if this transmission was originally in French or English, as he was fluent in and frequently using both languages at the time, but he thinks the recording was in French. He does recall his colleagues announcing that they knew the identity of the speaker. One of them called out, "We know him. It's the Lone Ranger." The Lone Ranger was apparently a pilot who is well known to the intelligence community in the region. Since the transmission came through a joint CIA-NSA listening post, and the CIA was very active in the Congo at the time, Charles Southall believes that the only reason he was able to hear this secret recording was because the CIA had a hand in killing Hammarskjöld. Said Southall, quote, "If the CIA didn't order Hammarskjöld's death, at least they paid for the bullet." For decades, Charles Southall tried to get his former colleagues to open up about the transmission they heard after midnight on September 18, 1961. He even contacted the State Department to try to get them to release the tape of the recorded transmission, which he says theoretically should still exist. But he has had no luck. Charles Southall's story on his face sounds pretty strange. And even though he's got an impressive resume as a Navy pilot, intelligence officer, longtime communications specialist, you could say there's no reason to take his story at face value, since we're just trusting this man's memory of an event that happened 60 years ago. But there's a few other details that seem to back up Southall's story, in my opinion. Susan Williams found that in 1994, a Swedish flying instructor named Tore Meyer gave an interview with Sweden's largest daily paper. In 1961, Meyer was working at an Air Force base in Ethiopia, and on the night of September 17th, he was trying out a new shortwave radio that a friend sold to him. While switching around on the frequencies, he suddenly picked up a transmission in English from an airport control tower. He remembers hearing the name Indola. A voice on the shortwave radio was describing the arrival of an incoming transport plane to the airport, and then suddenly saying, quote, "Another plane is approaching from behind. What is that?" The transmission abruptly stopped. Although Meyer reported what he heard to the local authorities at the time, nothing seemed to come of it. The Swedish investigation in 1993 dismissed Meyer's account, claiming it was unlikely that he could have heard the conversation as he described it. But this seems to come from a mistaken belief that Meyer picked up a conversation between two flight controllers at Indola over VHF, something the Swedish inspector thought was unlikely to happen. But in Charles Southall's opinion, Meyer was most likely listening to a shortwave transmission between Indola and Lusaka airports on HF. Airports in this region at the time frequently communicated through HF as a nighttime frequency. So, perhaps Meyer's story was cast aside too quickly by the Swedish investigators. In more recent years, another piece of evidence came out that I think substantiates Charles Southall's claim. In 2014, the United States declassified a series of diplomatic cables to Washington from the U.S. ambassador in the Congo. One message was sent the morning of September 18, 1961. In it, the ambassador announces that Hammarskjöld's plane has been lost over Rhodesia. And though he does not directly implicate Rhodesia or South Africa, he clearly suspects a mercenary pilot he names Vak Riesegel. This is very likely a misspelling of the name Jan van Riesegem, a Belgian pilot who worked for South Africa and Rhodesia before becoming the chief of Katanga's small air force, where he flew a Fuga Magister jet. The U.S. ambassador suggests that van Riesegem be prevented from flying until further notice. In another declassified cable from that September the 16th, the ambassador claims that von Riesegem's plane flew wing-to-wing with his own in a threatening maneuver. The documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld digs a little further in on Jan van Riesegem, finding an old paratrooper colleague of his from flight school. During an interview, he admits that van Riesegem told him directly he was the pilot who shot down Hammarskjöld's plane. And another interesting bit of information that lines up with Charles Southall's story: during his service with the Royal Air Force in World War II, von Riesegem earned the nickname Lone Ranger because of his ability to fly lone missions at night. This lines up with Southall's recollection that other NSA agents recognized the pilot by the same call sign. It should be noted that von Riesegem adamantly denied that he was responsible for shooting down the Albertina whenever he was asked about this in public, and he claimed that his flight records prove his innocence, as he wasn't even in Katanga in September 1961. However, these logs were merely just self-written records. He could have just lied about that. Plus, the declassified cable from the U.S. ambassador seems to contradict van Riesegem's story, as the ambassador claims that he saw his jet engage in a threatening maneuver with his own plane near Katanga airspace. Based on what I know now, I think that von Riesegem is the most likely suspect for who shot Hammarskjöld down. But there's another credible theory that could explain what happened. This one proposes that the pilot of the other aircraft actually intended to direct the Albertina to a different location in Katanga, merely holding the plane hostage so they could force Hammarskjöld to meet with members of the Katanga lobby on their own terms. This theory surfaced in 1967, when the former UN Secretariat, Claude de Camularia, met with a group of Belgian mercenaries who claimed to have carried out this exact mission. The only problem was, the hijacking was botched. A Belgian pilot, who we only know by his last name, Buckles, confessed to de Camularia that he originally flew next to the Albertina and sent a radio message in French that he was redirecting their flight to a base in Katanga, and they should comply or he would open fire. The pilots of the transport plane replied they would need to check to see if they could proceed with the order. Buckles was ordered to give his target 1 minute to comply before firing a warning shot. And after a minute passed, he dropped behind and above the DC-6, then fired a few rounds from his machine gun to shoot some tracer bullets near the plane. The only problem is, he accidentally hit it, and then the Albertina burst into flames and crashed. Buckles claims he was not told by his employers that his target was Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. It was only later that he would learn he accidentally assassinated the Secretary General of the UN. I think this story is possible, but I believe there's more evidence pointing to von Riesegem as the pilot who shot down Hammarskjöld. The UN official, Claude de Camularia, however, thought that Buckles was telling the truth. And the pilot's testimony does explain two unresolved mysteries from the crash. One of them, the bodies of two French-speaking security personnel were found near the cockpit of the plane at the scene of the crash. Investigators have long been puzzled by this placement. But if the Swedish pilots called on the native French speakers aboard the Albertina to double-check the French radio transmission from Birkel's hostile aircraft, it could be a reason why they were near the cockpit. Also, remember when I said that on the night of the crash, Lord Allport, the High Commissioner to Rhodesia, insisted that Hammarskjöld probably just redirected his plane at the last minute? UN investigators cited Allport's statements as a key reason why the search and rescue mission for the crash was so delayed. Nobody could ever figure out why Allport would say such a thing. But if he was in on the plan to redirect Hammarskjöld by force to Katanga, it might explain why he said that. Until the case is fully investigated, all of this is conjecture. If we accept that Dag Hammarskjöld's plane was probably shot down, then who ordered it to happen? The incident occurred in the midst of the Congo crisis, a sprawling conflict that involved the decolonization movement, the Cold War, and multinational mining corporations. Hammarskjöld's decision to use force against the mercenaries in Katanga made it clear that he was finally committed to defending the sovereignty of an independent Congo, and this made him a lot of powerful enemies who now had motive to kill him. Let's take a look at some of the suspects. First, we turn to Britain. At this time, the government of the UK was led by the Conservative Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. Macmillan largely reversed his party's stance on decolonization in a speech before the South African Parliament known as the Wind of Change speech. Although Macmillan expressed a moderate, half-hearted endorsement of decolonization as just a fact of life that Great Britain would have to accept, the right wing of his party was furious. In reaction, they formed the Monday Club, a sort of think tank for members of the right wing of the Conservative Party who wanted to preserve British imperialism, especially in Africa. This group formed a lobby to defend the independence of Katanga, seeing it as a vital buffer state between the anti-colonial African nations who they viewed as influenced by communism and the white supremacist nations of South Africa and the Rhodesian Federation, which the Monday Club supported. The Monday Club also had material interests in fighting decolonization. Some prominent members were on the board of the Union Minière mining firm in Katanga, or they owned interests in African railways that ran through Katanga and the Rhodesian Copper Belt. Many members of the Monday Club and the Katanga lobby were also thoroughly entrenched in the British intelligence community, with some members in high positions at MI6. And we now know from declassified documents that the MI6 did have an agent, Neil Ritchie, active in Rhodesia at the time of the crash, and that he may have helped broker the meeting location between Moise Tshombe and Dag Hammarskjöld. Another culprit is the CIA. There's no evidence directly pinning the crash of the Albertina on the United States, but the Congo was becoming something of a proxy battlefield of the Cold War. Various U.S. government agencies did intervene directly in Congolese affairs, from bribing Colonel Mobutu to secure his loyalty, to attempting to poison Patrice Lumumba. If Charles Southall's story of hearing the secret recording of the Hammarskjöld crash at a CIA listening post is true, then it's possible that the Central Intelligence Agency played some role. I think the most likely culprit is a combination of several suspects, all driven by the bottom line of the Union Minière Mining Company. Union Minière was in possession of vast mineral resources, and through its puppet government of Katanga, it fielded its own army of white mercenaries and African recruits, plus a small air force. By this point, this army was literally at war with the UN, and I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that they would have paid to have the Secretary General killed. I also don't think they would have had a hard time finding willing allies to help them, or volunteers to carry out the mission. Roy Walensky, the Prime Minister of the Rhodesian Federation, was on the brink of war with the UN himself by the fall of 1961, and the business interests of Union Minière certainly aligned with prominent British officials who had investments in or near the Congo. But there's one more possibility that both Susan Williams and Göran Björkdahl investigated, and I have to say, it's probably the weirdest one. It has to do with South Africa during the apartheid era. In 1998, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was beginning to come to a close. This was the official system of public hearings of crimes committed during the apartheid regime. In exchange for amnesty, perpetrators of crimes against individuals or groups of people could come forward and give testimony about what they had done or what they witnessed. The idea was to provide the public of South Africa a truthful account of the atrocities committed during the country's period of white minority rule. In July of 1998, as the TRC was compiling its final report, a researcher in the commission's head office took home a batch of previously classified documents and found something she had never seen before. A group of 12 papers that referred to something called Operation Celeste, an elaborate plot to blow up Dag Hammarskjöld's plane. One file also stated that CIA chief Alan Dulles had knowledge of the plan, as well as the British agency MI5. The letterhead and signatures of the paper were from an organization called the South African Institute for Maritime Research, or SIMAR. The researcher for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was puzzled by these documents, since she had never heard of SIMAR before. Shortly before the close of the commission, someone else then leaked these documents to the press. Officials from the CIA and British Foreign Office claimed no responsibility for what was contained in the SIMAR papers, even saying that they could be Soviet disinformation. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the chairman of the commission, addressed the SIMAR files in a press conference in 1998, stating that since the mandate for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was at an end, they could not investigate them. But he made it clear that they should be taken seriously. Archbishop Tutu said, quote, "It isn't something that's so bizarre. Things of that sort have happened in the past. That is why you can't dismiss them as totally, totally incredible." Although the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was never able to follow up on the SIMAR story, both Susan Williams and the makers of Cold Case Hammarskjöld did. And some of what the documentarians found caused a lot of controversy, which I'll get into in a bonus episode because it's not directly related to the plane crash. But Williams pulled on a thread with SIMAR that led her to some interesting places in the Hammarskjöld investigation. Though the original SIMAR files found by the TRC are unavailable, she did secure copies of some through a former official of the commission. The files detail a scheme to plant operatives of SIMAR at the Leopoldville airport, then hide a package of TNT under the wheel bay of Hammarskjöld's plane. This could have been possible, as the plane was inexplicably left unguarded at the airport for several hours. But when the payload failed to detonate, the plotters dispatched a, quote, eagle to take down the plane as it neared the runway at Ndola. This was likely a reference to a mercenary pilot. Now, there are some strange things about this one particular paper that caused some investigators to think it was a forgery, and I think I agree. For one, it is very odd that it implicates in writing the CIA, MI5, and even Alan Dulles by name in a conspiracy to murder the head of the UN. There are also some references to Special Ops Executive. This was a British intelligence service that closed in 1946, so it couldn't have existed when Hammarskjöld was killed. However, like Desmond Tutu said, we can't dismiss SIMAR as totally, totally incredible. And Susan Williams uncovered proof that SIMAR did in fact exist. In a transcript from a Truth and Reconciliation questioning in 1997, a white South African mercenary admitted that he once applied to work for something called the South African Institute for Maritime Research in 1989. Williams also tracked down an investigative reporter in South Africa who interviewed a man named Keith Maxwell in 1990. Maxwell was listed as a commodore of SIMAR in the file that details the plot against Hammarskjöld, and he claimed in his 1990 interview that he was in charge of something called Delta Intelligence Operations. Keith Maxwell also gave the reporter an unpublished memoir about Saimar that described a shadowy intelligence agency that was at war with the UN. Maxwell apparently fed his reporter a mixture of fact and fiction. This was either out of his own delusions or to deliberately confuse the public. He claimed that Saimar was founded nearly 200 years prior, during the Napoleonic War, as a shipwrecked treasure-hunting society, which I find hard to believe. Maxwell also claimed that Saimar was at that point run on a cell system, with operations carried out independently, not just across South Africa, but the entire continent. I find this part to be plausible. In 1981, a group of South African mercenaries engaged in a failed coup attempt and invasion against the socialist government of Seychelles, just off the coast of Africa. At least one member of the invading force was found to be a member of Saimar. Most of the concrete evidence that we have about Saimar suggests that it was a far-right paramilitary organization and a mercenary recruitment firm active in the 1980s and early 90s. This isn't out of the ordinary. Those types of organizations certainly existed in South Africa at the time. And since Keith Maxwell admitted in his memoir that he would have been only 14 years old when Hammarskjöld was killed, I think it's unlikely he had a hand in it. But then an anonymous source caught wind of Susan Williams' research and reached out to her with new information. He claimed to have been a member of Saimar and corroborated Maxwell's account that it was a very old organization. He forwarded a letter dated from 1947 from a man named F. Mallon, who lists himself as a commodore in Saimar, detailing a plan to send another associate in the organization to America to train in espionage under an assumed identity. The F. Mallon letter comes with its original envelope, which was marked with official letterhead from a South African government department. If this letter is genuine, which Williams believes it might be, that means Saimar existed at least as far back as the 1940s. What's more, one of the letters in the Saimar collection that mentions the 1961 plot to blow up Hammarskjöld's plane matches the handwriting of the F. Mallon letter from 1947. It's likely that at least one of the documents from the Saimar papers found by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was forged by Keith Maxwell. It's possible that all of them were. But if the Mallon letter from 1947 is genuine, and if the paper from 1961 that matches its handwriting is too, that means that Saimar might have been the group that had Dag Hammarskjöld killed. We just don't know for sure who did it. And we never will until the case is thoroughly and honestly investigated. Thanks to the efforts of independent historians and researchers like Susan Williams and Göran Björkdahl, the UN agreed to reopen the inquiry into Dag Hammarskjöld's death in 2014. The UN asked that 14 nations appoint their own investigators and open intelligence materials from the archives that were relevant to the crash. In 2019, the UN panel released a report claiming the theory that Hammarskjöld's plane was attacked, quote, remained plausible. Unfortunately, this investigation has hit a snag. Four key countries have dragged their feet on releasing intelligence records related to the crash: the United Kingdom, Russia, South Africa, and the United States. The UN investigation is still ongoing, though they have confirmed a reasonable suspicion that Hammarskjöld's plane was brought down by force. We may not find a smoking gun until these governments bring forward the necessary evidence. Hammarskjöld's legacy is forever tied with the mysterious circumstances of his death. But in life, his commitment to social justice and the independence of less powerful nations made him one of the most respected leaders in the history of the United Nations. Unlike many European statesmen in his era, he welcomed the end of colonization in the African continent, condemned white minority rule, and forcefully argued for the radical idea of one person, one vote. Hammarskjöld wasn't perfect, but he stood for these democratic principles even as he was condemned, even as he was pressured, and even as he faced threats to his own life. Thanks for listening to Conspiracy You Can Believe In and for bearing with me during my break. I'll return with a bonus episode later this month with a little more about the South African Institute for Maritime Research, as well as some other secret crimes committed by the apartheid-era government. Thanks for listening.